Beautiful. Our message from the Bible today is taken from John 8, verses 2 to 11. At dawn, he appeared again in the temple courts. This is Jesus, where all the people gathered around him, and he sat down to teach them. The teachers of the law and the Pharisees brought in a woman caught in adultery. They made her stand before the group and said to Jesus, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. In the law, Moses commanded us to stone such women. What do you say?" They were using this question as a trap in order to have a basis for accusing him. But Jesus bent down and started to write on the ground with his finger. When they kept on questioning him, he straightened up and said to them, "Let any one of you who is without sin be the first to throw a stone at her." Again he stooped down and wrote on the ground. At this, those who heard began to go away one at a time, the older ones first, until only Jesus was left, with the woman still standing there. Jesus straightened up and said to her, "Woman, where are they? Has no one condemned you?" And she said, "No one, sir." "Then neither do I condemn you," Jesus declared. "Go now and leave your life of sin."
Morning. I was resonating with Jill when she was saying how much you hate having not having morning teas and being able to socialise, because I do actually find this. I've come here a few times and I do find you an extremely friendly church. And I often tell people about what I thought was quite a funny moment in this church last time I was here, when we all had to be more socially distanced than you are now. We had to wear masks back at the kind of early stages of lockdown and all that jazz. And, you know, Paul, who's the friendliest guy in the world, like at the end of the service announced, like, "Now that the service has ended, please don't mingle or congregate. Remain on your chair, and as soon as you leave your chair, you must leave the premises immediately." And I remember thinking, this sounds weird coming out of your mouth. Like, as soon as you leave your chair, you must leave this building immediately. And the thing I thought was hilarious, God love you, you're so sweet people, you're all keeping your chair stuck to your bottom and, like, moving over to talk to each other. So in the end, I had, like, three people around me. Like, they were still in their chairs. And I was like, I don't think this is quite the letter of the law here somehow. Like, so just, like, you must be dying not being able to hang out with each other. So I've noticed how friendly you are. Thank you for having me. And please don't speak to me afterwards. Leave this meeting as soon as you possibly can. Look, I am going to speak about Bless, and I may not be coming at it quite the way you might have expected, because we're going to look at a story which was just read to us and which I know that you know very, very well. And by way of introduction, I want to tell you about a book that I think that you might find helpful, although I'm not entirely certain that you're likely to go and read it. It was published in German in 1923. So you can see I'm really keeping up with all the latest reading at Magdalen College. We're right on top of the latest things that are being published. It was written by a guy called Martin Buber. It's called Ich und Du in German. If there are any German speakers here, I'm really sorry for that bad translation, but pronunciation. But it's translated into English technically, like literally, as I and you. And Buber, a Jewish philosopher, said that when it came to human social interactions, we tend to orient ourselves toward other people in one of two ways. We either see people as a you, which is kind of as an it, as an object. We distance ourselves, we other that person. We see them as an object that may or may not be useful for us, and we engage with that person, either by dispensing with them if they have no kind of function or utility to us, or we engage with them to the degree to which they can fulfill our needs or our interests. Or, he said, we can relate to people as a thou. Now, We sang How Great Thou Art. Well, no, we didn't sing it. We listened to other people singing it a little bit earlier. It's a really archaic English word. It used to be used in English when somebody of a lower social status was addressing someone they considered to be higher than them. If you were talking to a nobleman or a king or someone that you considered to be of a higher social status or rank or class to you, you would use the word thou. The word you was considered kind of too familiar. Does that make sense? And we Christians kind of hang on to it because it was also the word that was used to refer to God. It seemed way too familiar back in the day to call God you, like we often do. Back in the day, you couldn't do that, so you would refer to God as thou. And we still have it hanging around because we sing really old-fashioned songs like How Great Thou Art. What Buber was saying was this: when you treat somebody as a thou, it's not so much like you're elevating them or you're higher than me. He used the term to describe the kind of stance you adopt when you're engaging with people who you recognize as having inherent dignity and worth, someone who you want to honor and acknowledge their inherent common humanity with you. Can you see how treating someone as an it, as an object, based on your past experience of them, whether they're useful to you or not, is one way of engaging with people? And to engage with people as a thou, as a somebody who is inherently interesting, with their inherent sense of dignity and complexity and respect. Can you see how they're very different ways of engaging with people? Now, as a Jewish philosopher, he was also making the point that we ought to treat people as thou, because as Jews, he would say, we believe that all people bear the image of God. And so in the same way as we might treat God as thou and honouring and respecting God, we therefore ought to treat all people who are the sons and daughters of God in that way. Does this make sense? And yet, very often, more often than not, what we find ourselves dealing with is in a world of it rather than a world of thou. Now, he's a Jewish philosopher, but I would say that we could agree with him very much in that respect, and we could even kind of up the ante, because for us, we would say that God has truly revealed himself perfectly and most sublimely in the incarnation, in the person of Jesus. And what you find when you read the Gospels through, and if I sow this seed into your mind, I hope when you read the Gospels, you'll see it because it's glaring. What you find in the Gospels is that Jesus treats the people he engages with, even though he is God, even though he is sinless, even though he has come from God to institute this new covenant, he treats all people as thou. He treats people as inherently interesting, as inherently dignified. He honours those people he engages with. But what you'll discover is, not discover like you've never read the Gospels before, but when you look at it through these lens, you'll see he is swimming in a sea of people who treat others as it. It's like everywhere you go, the Pharisees, the disciples, the people around him are treating each other as objects. And he, in the midst of a world where people are being treated as objects, comes and reveals to this extraordinary alternative way of being and doing, of treating people as thou, as inherently dignified. I'll give you a few examples. Jesus, whenever he healed somebody on the Sabbath, he really, really ticked off the Pharisees. You familiar with this? Like that really got their goat. For them, it was like, if you heal someone on a Sabbath, that means technically you're working on the Sabbath. That means you're breaking the law of Moses. That means you're breaking the law of God. Therefore, you can't be from God. It was like their lay down Messiah. That was their like, gotcha, you're not the Messiah because you healed somebody on the Sabbath. You're working on the Sabbath. Like that was the thing that they just used to go crazy about. And if you read the Gospels through again, you'll discover Jesus heals lots of people on the Sabbath. I think he almost kind of keeps it up until the Sabbath because he knows how much it's going to annoy them. In Matthew chapter 12, it happens again. It's not the only instance. He heals someone on the Sabbath. And they're like, gotcha! You can't be from God because you just broke the law of God. And Jesus reminds them, wait a second. Built into the law of Moses is actually a loophole on our Sabbath law. If one of your animals should fall into a ditch or a canyon or get themselves stuck or in trouble, there is actually a loophole for those of us on the Sabbath to rescue our sheep from life and limb. He says, are you telling me, honestly, that you are more concerned, you think there's greater worth for a sheep that is in trouble on Sabbath than for the people that I'm healing on the Sabbath? Can you hear what's implied by what he's saying? You don't care that I've healed this person. You're not delighted with their new life. You're not thrilled that now their disease or their sickness has left them. You're not excited about how you can now incorporate them back into mainstream life and society. You're not praising God for the power of God that has set them free. You are just seeing this as an opportunity to get me. You are looking right past the healed person in order to fulfill your particular agenda. That is the world of I and it. Does that make sense? In John chapter 9, even Jesus' disciples are guilty of this. Jesus and his disciples happen upon a man who was born blind. Now, people who were born with deformities or disabilities in ancient times were a huge conundrum for ancient people. Because ancient people, including the Jews, tended to think that sickness or disease or deformity of some kind was the result of punishment from God. The Jews fell into the trap of thinking this, but the pagans also thought it. That if you're blind or sick or deformed in some way, you've been punished for something that you've done. But if you are born with a disability, like what? Hold on. You can't be guilty of having done anything wrong, so how did this happen? And so it then sort of came down to, oh, maybe it was your parents then, though, that you're bearing the punishment for their iniquity in some way. And the disciples have fallen into this. At the beginning of John chapter 9, they come across a man born blind, and the disciples don't say, oh my gosh, look at this poor man born blind. I mean, what kind of life will he have? What kind of life will his parents have? They don't say, Jesus, we know what you can do. Like, get to work. Like, heal this man. There's no compassion. There's no immediate leaning into this person. They see this guy as like an object lesson. And they say, oh, Jesus, this is a teachable moment for us. I've been meaning to ask you this. Like, would you say it was like his sin? That can't be right, can it? Or do you think it maybe is his parents' sin that has led him to being blind? Can you see what they're doing? They're simply schooled in the world of I and it. But Jesus is the man from I and thou. Ah, he says neither his sin nor his parents' sin. And then he glorifies his God through healing this man. It's everywhere in the Gospels. People using or abusing others. And in the story that was read to us before, I think it's the most heinous example in all the Gospels, don't you? Here is a woman caught in adultery, dragged by a self-righteous mob out into the streets. Note, will you, that her lover is not also under condemnation for adultery. Note that only the woman is going to be stoned for having committed adultery. Because in this time, even women are treated as it, as things, as objects. And somehow a man gets a free pass on this one. This woman is dragged out into the street under the penalty of death. Now, I don't think I could even imagine, I don't even try to imagine, how horrific it must be to stone someone to death, let alone to be stoned to death. I mean, imagine the sheer white, hot panic, the terror of facing such an unspeakable demise. And under the penalty of this barbaric death, the Pharisees and the teachers of the law say, whoa, 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 boys, hold up. Wait a second. Let's drag her down to where Jesus is teaching. Because we could use this as a way to trap Jesus. Folks, this is the world of I and it. This is a thing. This is an object. This is a tool that we might use, an instrument by which we might embarrass or humiliate somebody else with whom we're in opposition. This is the way of the world, said Martin Buber in 1923. And this is the world in which Jesus finds himself. This woman is dragged down and thrown at Jesus' feet. Ha ha! Gotcha! What do you say about this? Folks, as a pastor, I've had opportunity to sit with people as they've breathed their last and been with families as they've grieved. But I have never been, I don't think I ever want to be, with somebody who is walking to their execution or to their death as this woman would be. But I have a couple of friends in Victoria, Rob and Christy Buckingham, who are pastors of Bayside Community Church. And through various ways and means, they ended up becoming quite connected to the Bali Nine. You're familiar with, remember the Bali Nine and the drug importation charges and the two ringleaders, Myron Sukumaran and Andrew Chan, who were condemned to death. And Christy, over a period of years, ended up becoming, in a way, an unofficial chaplain to both Myron Sukumaran and Andrew Chan. And in fact, I don't know if you follow that story particularly well, but Andrew Chan ended up becoming a very committed Christian during his years on death row. She was called and told that the date of their execution had been set, and she was summoned quickly to Bali. She flew there. She was with them there on the last day of their lives. She was with them as they were transported to a ferry and then taken to an island off the coast of Bali, away from the media, where they were executed. And she's written and spoken a lot about what it was like to be with them on that last day of their lives. But one of the things I recall her saying was she was astonished by how all of the prison guards and people that handled Andrew and Myron, those who transported them, everyone who was involved with them, pretty much, refused to make eye contact with the condemned men, treated them in the most minimal kind of fashion, giving instructions or leading them to where they had to be or what they had to do. There was a sense in which she said, in order, it felt to her, in order for them to carry out this sentence, they had to treat them as an it. To see them as a thou would be too much, knowing what they were going to do to them. Which speaks, if you say, ask me, quite well of the Indonesians. How could we see someone as a thou and then carry out a sentence like that? It's as if we have to see them as an object and we're just doing our job. Well, this is far worse here in John chapter 8. This is not just treating you as an it in order to help me carry out a sentence. This is, you are an it. You are an object. I can dismiss you. I can execute you. I can use you. And when you think about it, friends, even though this is a very dramatic example, don't you and I live in the world of I and it all the time? Don't we reject those with whom we have very little use or interest? Don't we condemn those that we hardly know, but we don't like them because they're too far on the left or the right, or they're too Labor or they're too Liberal, or they're too black or they're too white, or they're too this or they're too that? Don't we find ourselves in the same way, objectifying people, caricaturing people, rejecting people, condemning people, using people? You and I live in the world of I and it as well. We treat people as its and they treat us as its. It may not be as dramatic as John chapter 8, but it's the air that we breathe. It's the world in which we live. And yet, our King, our friend, our Saviour, King Jesus, does not live in the world of it. And even when he is with us in the world of it, he will not reduce himself to the rules of I and it. Jesus treats people as thou. And in fact, Jesus' response to this angry mob, it's breathtaking. In fact, his one line to them is probably one of the most quoted verses in the whole of the Bible, by Christians and by non-Christians, both in context and out of context. Let the one who is out sin cast the first stone. Some people quote that as if to say, let's let people do whatever they want to do. But actually what he's saying is this. He's saying, stop. And you notice how John talks to us about how he kind of withdraws. He crouches down. He separates himself from the world of I and it. He writes in the dirt. He slows the whole mob down. And then there's one line. Let the one who is out sin cast the first stone. Forces them to think about their own righteousness and worthiness by comparison with the woman. This one line invites this angry mob to see her as thou. to acknowledge our common humanity. To recognize though she has sinned in this way, I have sinned in myriad other ways. In this one line he says, you are inflamed in the world of I and it, but stop and consider just for 1 minute what it would be like to treat her as thou. And then see if you can carry out this sentence. And as you know, one by one, they abandon their task. This is the power of I and thou. And you find Jesus doing it again and again and again. Everyone in the Gospels that Israelites considered to be objects, to be its, to be lesser, to be nobodies, whether that be Romans, Gentiles, like say the Roman centurion who trusts in Jesus' healing power. What does Jesus say to the Roman centurion? In front of the whole crowd, he says, never have I seen such faith in all of Israel. What an affirmation. An affirmation of a man who hasn't read the law of Moses, hasn't been circumcised, hasn't been ushered into the first covenant with Israel. He acknowledges this it. He acknowledges him as a thou filled with faith greater than anyone else he's encountered. When a bleeding woman reaches out and touches the hem of his garment, I already said to you, this is a world where women are treated as it, but a bleeding or hemorrhaging woman, an unclean woman, all the more an it, all the more an object. And when she reaches out in the hope that just touching him might heal her, and she is healed, Jesus brings her into the middle of the assembly of men and says, for their benefit, I think, more than for hers, it is your faith that made you well. He honors her contribution to her own healing that she reached out in faith. Time and again you see it happening. I remember the story of the 10 lepers that Jesus heals and only one comes back to thank him. I remember learning about that, about how we should always say thanks for things. But the one that comes back is a Samaritan. It. Other, lower, less than. The Samaritan comes back praising God and rejoicing for God's great grace to him through Jesus. And again, Jesus says to a Samaritan whose theology is all wrong and history is all wrong and whose bloodline is all wrong, he says, it's your faith that made you well. Do you see what Jesus is doing? Jesus is elevating those who are downtrodden. He's looking into the eyes of those that people ignore. He's taking people who have been used to being treated as objects, as its, as useful or unuseful, and he affirms their inherent dignity. He honors them and loves them, even though he is, in fact, better, greater than them. Do you follow? Years ago, I was in San Francisco and I was researching a book about different ways of doing church. And lots of people, often after I'd interviewed them, would say, oh, you should go and meet a guy called Brock Bingaman down at the Subterranean Shoe Room on Valencia Street in the Mission District. And I'd ask, who is he? And they'd say, oh, he owns this shoe store on Valencia Street. And I was like, yeah, no, I'm looking for like different ways of doing church more than kind of business. No, they said, I think you'd be kind of quite into him. You should go and meet him. So I happened to be, I didn't make an appointment, I happened to be going down Valencia Street in the Mission District and I see Subterranean Shoe Room. So I think, oh, well, enough people have told me I should meet him, so I go in. Now, it's just a shoe store. You know what a shoe store looks like, right? It's like shelves of shoes all around the walls. And then in the middle of the shoe store was this big kind of chaise lounge, which I guess you sit on while you try on shoes, right? So I walk in, it's a quiet time of the day, there's no other customers in there. Oh, he says, well, all shoe store attendants say, hey, can I help you? And I said, well, actually, I'm not even looking for shoes. I've just been doing this research and a bunch of church leaders have said I should come and talk to you. Why have they told me that? He says, I don't know. He said, I was a Southern Baptist church planter, he said, and I came to San Francisco to plant a church and it didn't really take, and so I had to fall back on my first love. I said, well, what's your first love? He said, my first love? Shoes. He said, I love shoes. I've been collecting shoes since I was like a kid. This guy is the Imelda Marcos of the Southern Baptist Convention, right? He said, I know shoes, I love shoes, so I thought I'd open a shoe store. But I said, well, why would people say, while I'm talking to them about new ways of like doing faith communities, that I should talk with you? He says, oh, maybe it's because I've got a bit of a funny technique about how to sell shoes. He said, when customers come into my store, I go over to them like all shoe store attendants do, like I did to you. I go over and I say, can I help you? And he says, you know, like 8 or 9 times out of 10, people say, well, not really sure what I'm looking for. I'm just going to have a look. And he says, I have a line that I always deliver to that. I always respond with this line. I say, well, if you have a little bit of time and you'd like to sit on the lounge and tell me your life story, I'll tell you what kind of shoes you're looking for. And he says, people usually go, okay. People sit on the lounge and they tell me their life story. Some people somehow manage to tell me their life story in 5 or 10 minutes. I grew up here, I went there, I do this job, blah, 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 blah. But some people like tell me in great detail. I don't rush them and I don't slow them down. You tell me your life story as long as it takes. I've heard about those who grew up here, went to school there, were abused here, were sexually assaulted there, were divorced, married, remarried, like Jewish, Hindu, Baptist, Anglican. I hear it all. This is like outcomes, their life story. And I just listen. He said, I'm not a therapist or a counselor. I'm a Southern Baptist church planter. I don't have a caring bone in my body. Sorry, that's a church planter joke, but... He said, I'm not a counselor, I'm not giving them therapy. I just listen to their life story. And I know shoes. So after they've told me their whole life story, I say to them, stay here. And I go and I select a pair of shoes for them. And I come back and I say, are these the shoes you're looking for? And he says, most of them say, after they've just unburdened themselves with their whole life story, they say, that's exactly the shoe I'm looking for. And then later, as they're leaving, they say to me, so, who are you? Like, what's your story? And he says, I'm a shoe store guy. No, they say, no, you're not a shoe store guy. Like, what are you? Like, you're a therapist, a psychoanalyst? Are you a, no, I'm a shoe store guy. Like, what are you? Some kind of guru? Are you some sort of kind of Zen kind of guy? Or, no, I'm a shoe store guy. And then he says, so many of them have then said to me, you got to meet my husband. Yeah, I got a party on Saturday night. You got to meet my friends. I want to introduce you to my daughter would love to. Like, he said, I've just met so many people. We've now got a whole community of people that gather together in my basement. It's a new way of doing church. And he said, I guess in a city like San Francisco, where no one feels listened to, listening is pure gold. Friends, it translates even to middle class Southern Shire suburbia, does it not? Everyone's used to being treated as an it. Everyone's used to treating everyone else as an it. That's the way of the world. But when you encounter somebody who treats you as thou, do you follow? My wife is like this. My wife was trained as a therapist and a counselor. But for a number of years, she was running a project with Baptist Care in Petersham, working particularly with homeless people and those in boarding houses, which are just one rung up the ladder from homelessness. Working with some really very troubled and socially, economically disadvantaged people, some with mental illness, some with histories of incarceration, some really kind of tough people, to be honest. She ended up like... setting up a drop-in center and an op shop and a kind of coffee bar thing. And then she set up a big chicken run down an alley behind an old boarding house. And then kind of homeless people and people in the boarding houses were given a free chicken if they applied for one. And she said one of her joys was sitting with all these guys and they could tell her which was her chicken and they all had names for them. And And then they'd all collect the eggs, and then the local butcher would give bacon, have a big kind of fry up once a week. And I was doing a whole bunch of stuff with these people. But I remember attending when she was doing a presentation with Baptist Care about her work. And she had a bunch of slides that she was clicking through. And she'd prepared kind of her presentation. But then there was a section of the presentation where she said, I'm just going to show you some faces of the people that I work with. And these were close-up, like portrait-style shots. She'd got permission to show them to this presentation. She said, I'm just going to click through some of these. And she hadn't made note of who they were. She just wanted to click through them and let us kind of meet them. And so as she would click, because she didn't have them written down in order, she would have to kind of look around to see whose face had come on the screen. I only tell you that because as she clicked, she'd sort of look around, and her instinctual reaction to this face was to say, oh, this is Bob. Oh, he is such a beautiful, beautiful man. And you would look at Bob. He had facial tattoos or half his teeth missing or, you know, matted hair, scraggly beard, or he did not look like a beautiful, beautiful man. She'd click on the next one. Oh, this is Joan. Oh, gosh, she has such a gorgeous, generous heart. She'd click through each of these shots, and we would look at this cavalcade of faces, which, for those of us who don't know them, we might consider to be pretty unattractive-looking faces. And with each glance, she was filled again with just how beautiful or wonderful or generous or kind or sad each of these people were. And numbers of us were talking later and they said, well, she sees something in those people we couldn't see just from seeing their faces. Damn straight. She's like Jesus, isn't she? Like, we see people about whether they're clean enough, whether they're middle class enough, whether they're liberal votey enough, whether they're left enough, right enough. We see people that way, caricatures based on past experience. That's how we see people, useful to us or not. But what does it look like to be Jesus-y in this world? It's to look into the lives and hearts of others and to see them as thou, as beautiful, beautiful people, to see their sadness, to see their pain, to see their joy, to see their dignity and their worth and their value, to say like Jesus said, good on you. It's your faith that made you well. Good on you. I've never seen such faith in all of Israel. Do you follow? Do you know what it means to bless somebody? You can buy them a gift, sure. You can send them a check, yeah, I guess. But to bless somebody is to attend to them, to listen to them, to genuinely hear them. And if you're going to buy them a gift or spend time with them or do something for them, to do it or to buy it or to give it out of the knowledge of who they truly are, what their genuinely deepest needs might be, to listen, to honor, to elevate, to respect, to see as I and thou. Are you all with me? See, Martin Buber said, the reason why we should do this is because every person is made in the image of God. That's good. I agree. But also, you know what the Apostle Paul said to add to that? He said to the Romans, you should accept one another. You should treat each other as thou, just as Christ has accepted you. I think that's what it means when you say that you're committed to embracing the freedom to bless. Because blessing is not just another jolly program we've got to add onto the church. Oh, shucks, now I've got to bless people. Whew, as if this isn't hard enough. No, this is Jesus, the I and thou man, has treated me as thou. He's heard me. He's looked into my eyes. He's honored me. He's died for me. He's set me free from fear and sin and death and the devil. He holds me in his hands. He loves me. He said to me, your faith made you well. I've never seen such faith. He elevated and affirmed and dignified me. those of us who have met the I and thou man, those of us who know Jesus and that he has accepted us, are set free from the need to use people, set free from the need to manipulate people, set free from the world of I and it. Just as Christ has accepted us, we are free from the bonds of I and it to go and accept others and to look into their eyes and to say, what a beautiful, beautiful man you are. What a beautiful, beautiful woman you are. Do you follow? This is the freedom to bless. Let me say a prayer for you. Father, I thank you for this beautiful, beautiful church who indicate in all sorts of ways how much they love each other and enjoy each other and dignify and honour and practice what I am thou looks like in this place. Might it be, Father, that they continue to workshop and equip and train and disciple each other to be able to go out into this world and to treat work colleagues and neighbours and the parents of the kids that go to school with our kids and those we socialise with and all the interactions we have in this world, to see them as thou, to see them as people with inherent dignity, inherent needs and desires and hopes, to look deep into sometimes the hardest faces, sometimes the most resistant souls, and to dare to treat them as thou, just as you did that for us, to set us free from the need to use and manipulate and control others. Lord, continue to fill them with your spirit of I and thou, and send them out into the world to extend your kingdom of love and peace and grace. Amen.